present Oregon statute
uses?
Yes. And that's the model penal code language.
I think that you'd have to define it. If you didn't use something broad like users, you'd have to define it so thoroughly that you'd wind up leaving something out.
And that's why it's in the Michigan Code too. If he uses, well, it'd be redundant to say obtains benefits. They have the same stuff. We say uses for the purpose of obtaining profit or service. I think so.
Well, I think something like a verb such as uses is broad enough to cover your telephone credit card situation, whereas if we had a more specific verb such as presents, proof problems.
I think that broadness of
the
parts that just have the wrong pocket here.
He uses it for the purpose of paying property or services, knowing that it's stolen or forged, that it's been revoked or canceled, or that for any other reason is used to card is unauthorized by either the person who issued it or the person who took it issued. I think the definition in section 2 is a better definition than either that in the credit code or in the model penal code. I'm reluctant to say it.
Say it, Tom, say it.
Best we ever had.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I move section 10 be adopted.
The amendments.
Okay,
so second. Moved and seconded that we adopt section 10 as amended. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no.
Now, I don't know whether you want to go through all this commentary as we get on the other 2 seconds or not. Now, this is really a departure from our present law. There's just no question about it. Probably the total result of having a statute like this on the books wouldn't be a great deal different from except in one very important instance, and that's with respect to the no-account check. Some of the case law that was drawn up around that problem. But except for that, the effect may not be any different in the long run. However, the language is completely different. It's a whole new approach to check cases, and I suppose, preface my comments on this by saying, first of all, that I went back through and read some of the reread some of the minutes of the early meetings that the commission had way back in 1967 when we were just getting organized, and I noticed that this was one of the subjects that came up quite frequently when you were just asking for people to throw out subjects and areas that they felt were troublesome, and I know that we've received letters from district attorneys with respect to this. Courtney Johns from Lynn County testified before the commission one day and brought up the check problem. Justice Perry brought up the question of checks. There's quite a difference of opinion on both sides. I know some district attorneys feel that they would like to get out of the check business entirely.
They could spend some time on, collection statutes.
They would like to not even fuss with the problem of worthless checks. Others feel that we should have a check statute, but that we should eliminate this artificial distinction between a non-sufficient fund check and a no-account check that is thrown up because of cases like Broom versus Gladden.
Mr. Rubin talked at some length about this problem. If you remember that day, statement that it was scandals of the Jaybird that something ought to be done to limit the criminal aspect of the charge and make it make the merchant more responsible for cashing checks and at the same time letting him use his civil remedies to recover. I realize that as far as recovery is concerned, the civil remedy isn't going to do much for him. But most people who pass bum checks don't have anything, or they wouldn't be passing bum checks. There wouldn't be much for there's the occasional compulsive person. I do kind of hate to see the jail and pens full of people who have gone the 10, 15, or 60, $76 route.
Well, there's this thought that the only thing you're doing, I suppose, for the society and the community is that these incorrigible check writers, you're keeping them out of circulation for a while, is about all you're doing.
Yes, and 80% of them, having been kept out of circulation for a year and a half or so, will be out and be back in within 60 days to 6 months.
But I think Mr. Rubin's criticism was that there was such a high percentage of people in the penitentiary, not just Oregon but in other states, who were not really dangerous to society. And that
where the check writer is, 90% of cases, I guess, is an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And if you could cut off his hands and cut his throat so he couldn't drink, he'd be all right. And
but the prison isn't a place to dry out alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
And the state of roughly $3,000 a year is not really the taxpayer mm-hmm. state. I don't feel any compulsion to pay part of $3,000 a year to keep some guy out of circulation so that the tavern two blocks down and a block over can have a little better, have a little less problem with his credit rating.
Problem. I don't think they really have a solution for it.
It's really more of an administrative problem, I think. Whatever kind of statute we have, or we have none at all, it boils down to the way these laws are going to be administered through the prosecutors and through the police agencies and whatnot.
The check writers that are in the penitentiary are really pros. I mean, they have asked for it. The housewife that goes and writes a non-sufficient funds check is not prosecuted as such.
No, no.
And you really have to be determined and try real hard to get in the penitentiary to check a charge.
Well, that's correct. I agree with that.
The DA is pretty good about that.
Yes, I agree with that. But if they're in for a relatively short time, they're turned loose and they do it again. It's just they're never sent up on their first or second check charge. They probably had 15 or 20 or two dozen of them scattered around before they get arrested the first time.
There's this to be said, though, for a criminal prosecution with a check writer, and that is through probation or through the instrument of a suspended sentence, the court can put the heat on this guy and make him make restitution for the checks he's written. So there is some recovery for the victims.
And so on the first offense, on the first conviction, that's correct, but I think the circuit courts around the state generally do. First conviction, on particularly on this charge, sometimes on the second, we'll put them on probation and require restitution. But they almost always wind up out here violators of probation.
They can control their drinking to a degree too, in some cases. And the hardcore cases. Well, yeah, the hardcore cases. Yes, they wind up out here, but there's a great body of cases out here that are on probation and parole and so on, that they're having some success with that you don't see. And this hardcore group that you have at the penitentiary is almost a necessity to make these fellows over here believe that this is something you better do. And I think that's a problem. It's sort of like an iceberg in a way. This that you see out here at the penitentiary is really just the top of the thing, and it's a much bigger and deeper problem than what you see at the penitentiary.
You may recall that I asked Mr. Rubin the question whether he thought there was such a thing as an habitual criminal when he was discussing the inadvisability of putting paper hangers in jail. And he said that he didn't think so. I that was the net effect of his answer. The National Council on Crime and Delinquency, the Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency, and most of the commentators with respect to the terrible situation that we have here with so many check riders in prison fail, I think, to focus on the fact that most of these check riders are involved in related offenses. So very often, burglary of payroll check. This is where the real bad check rider or the serious felonies with respect to checks occur with theft of payroll checks and check protectors and things like that. And so very often you have guys that fell the first time on a car theft or something similar to that, go into the pen, and then on their second go around, having learned the tricks of the trade and inside the walls, come out and fall for negotiating bad checks. I think, personally, that the biggest single deterrent to the profession of check writer is strict enforcement of the Bitcher Criminal Act. There are inequities as far as that's concerned, and I'm not really opposed to the modification of that law, although I voted against it. But I know, and you know too, that when this code comes up for public hearing, one of the biggest arguments that we're going to get is going to come from those who feel that we should dilute the bad check statutes and do away with this. And I'm not so sure about this specific section. I think possibly that this might be covered by what we've already done with regard to forgery.
And I think we should keep in mind, too, that even if we eliminated from our proposed code any specific section dealing with checks, that in the tentative draft number one, our common theft provision, it would be theft by deception.
But don't you agree that the answer to the problem, if it is a problem, rests with the courts taking enlightened advantage of the services of parole and probation, and in the DA's using a little bit better judgment than maybe used some places now insofar as indicting persons for felony.
That brings up a different problem, of course, and that's the great variety of enforcement by district attorneys around the state. I mean, every one of us can think of personal time, climate time, for example. Yeah, there's some things going on in climate time, but Plymouth County at one time was resulting in every seventh person being sentenced to the state penitentiary was coming out of Plymouth County.
And that's the judge's fault.
And perhaps the district attorney's fault.
Of course, to digress, there was a bill that was introduced in the last session to give the attorney general some supervisory powers over the district attorneys insofar as setting policy is concerned.
And pass this
I got 35 irate letters.
From the district attorney?
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Well,
it's a possibility, too, that I'll pass this time. I didn't have a chance last time. Personalities.
We got two new district attorneys where you come up. We will receive their first pay as lawyers the day they take office as district attorneys. Ever at any practice, any time. We've got two or three others I can think of offhand who are way down on the experience scale. They're going to be in a couple of pretty good sized counties. To get back to this thing, I percentage of check writers and paper hangers in the state penitentiary in this state, and I assume those figures are correct. Is it because we have less crime of other, are we lower on the murder business? We've got fewer murders, we've got more check writers reporting murders because we have fewer murders.
Excuse me, I'll get it.
Do we have fewer car thieves? Do we have fewer? If we do that, then the proportion doesn't bother me so much. If it's just that we have unduly strict laws and unduly strict enforcement of them, then I think it's a different thing as regards just
particular. Oh, I don't think we have any. Well, you know, the state of Washington, for example, has the NSF check statute. NSF statute, which permits you to accumulate. In other words, you could write $50 checks in Oregon, and you could only be prosecuted for NSF misdemeanors, but you can bunch those together in Washington and charge them with a felony. You see? So, in this sense, our statutes are less oppressive.
Perhaps that's the reason we treat a check writer better than anyone, really. Overall, and so that's the crime that they gravitate to. See, you mentioned related offenses. They find out it's kind of tough on some of these other things. But here's something where it's safe and it's fairly easy, and preferred for that reason. So they go to that, and they might be seeking money at gunpoint in some other state, but in this state it's a little easier, so they go to this. But on this business of punishment, I'd like to comment on that. I had a fellow that we went to Louisiana to bring back, cost us $500 to bring back to Lane County. He was a crippled fellow. And he was sent up to the penitentiary, and I didn't see him again until just about the summer before last. And he had to introduce himself to me. And he identified himself, and I knew who he was. And he said that he was committed to the penitentiary. And he said he knew in 2 days that he didn't want to be there anymore. So he decided that he wasn't going to be there anymore, and he took jobs like collecting garbage and so on, because he was so certain that he didn't want any more of that stuff, that he would take any kind of job, or anything, to stay out of there. Now, that fella, now he's not a statistic that means anything, see? And yet there's his story, and his story has to stand by itself. And this business of punishment being a deterrent, I know, is real. But the statisticians and so on will come up with some warped figures that prove that it is a deterrent. So by golly, it is.
Oh, I'm sure it is. In some place, I've had 3 tons on the table in my place in the last 12 months. One of them's back now. One of them apparently doesn't want to ever be there again. And the third one is kind of fluttering along. He may go back yet. But I'm sure there's some. And the one who didn't, it took about 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, that's usually it.
Your mind, the problem is for the penitentiary to learn how to recognize those 3 or 4 day cures.
Yeah.
And get the parole board to turn them out in 30 days or 60 days.
No real way. No real way. Can't read a man's mind that way.
Well, let's, oh, do you have the statistics?
Well, I don't have statistics with respect to checks, check offenses, because neither the FBI's system of reporting nor the state system of reporting has a category for check offenses. And neither of them indicate whether they include check offenses under the larceny category. I don't think they do. But it's possible that these may move. I think they probably fall under other crimes, the other crimes category. So these statistics aren't too helpful.
Miscellaneous.
Yeah, you can go through here, and for many of these categories, like robbery, we can see what the state rate for robbery is and how it compares to the U.S. rate, whether it's going up or going down, and assaults and burglary. And
well, how do some of our other rates compare? How does robbery compare to state?
Is this for 67 that you have?
Well,
Yeah, this is the latest report. This is the 67 report from Oregon. And this is the 67 FBI report.
I think it'd be interesting to compare a town, let's say, the size of Eugene with Las Vegas. Now, here's where statistics will throw you off. A city the size of Eugene should have a higher armed robbery and that sort of thing than Las Vegas, Nevada, let's say. About the same size town, maybe. But Las Vegas, Nevada will have about four times the crime.
Why should Eugene have higher?
Well, because of the size of the town.
Mm-hmm.
Just numbers. All right, but you look at the crime statistics, or at least this used to be true, and Las Vegas had about four times the armed robberies. The reason is the fellows that go there.
Broke and stick up a service station to get out of town.
Right, and sure. Had to commit an armed robbery to get out of town. And, it's very difficult to prove anything with statistics.
They run for governor in Washington.
Yeah.
There's only, in 1966, there was only one category where the Oregon rate of crimes per 100,000 population exceeded the U.S. rate. We were substantially lower in most categories, but in the area, and it's interesting too, it's a forcible rate. The U.S. rate was 12.9, the state rate was 15. Everything else,
11 or 12.9?
12.9. So we would exceed the U.S. rate in that category, 2.1. But burglary, for example, we were below the U.S. rate, 143. Larceny, we were 109, less than the U.S. rate. All offenses, we were 593 per 1,000, per 100,000. Robbery, we were 37.6 less per 100,000.
You know, talking about statistics, when I worked at Big Burger, I used to take out a little girl that worked for John Sherman Cooper. Her daddy was a whiskey farmer down in Kentucky. And I gave her some articles that Newberger had written on the evils of alcohol and tobacco. And she gave back and she said, my daddy told me down in Kentucky that there are three kinds of lies. Lies, damn lies, and statistics. And you tell that. So, never saw her. What I'm interested in doing, and I think we can just go through this at HD, is why it's necessary to enact a special section for negotiating a worthless negotiation instrument when we included uttering under our definitional section of forgery and carry it through. Because uttering, you didn't say negotiate, but say utter a written instrument, the issue deliver, probably circulate, disseminate, transfer, send a written instrument to another. And we include uttering in various degrees of poetry.
Well, you have something to give away to the lobbyists.
Well, no, we're talking about forged checks. There. This is, here we're talking, and this is directed at the insufficient fund or the no account check.
Yes, yes.
And not a forged check. So this is
a no account check a forged check?
No. No, it means where you have no bank account.
But why isn't that represent that you have a bank account?
Yeah, but forgery is a
question. That's right.
Let's see.
This section 11 was just aimed at what 165225 now covers, and that is just the worthless check, not the forged check, but the worthless check. And that's why I had all new language in there.
So you believe this particular area has to get made covered. What about theft by deception?
Yeah.
No, I believe it's been covered under theft by deception.
Or OMFD.
Well, that's theft by deception encompasses OMFD. But, well, there were several considerations in this. One, I think, from a practical standpoint, we're going to run into some real problems with the acceptance of our code if we don't have some kind of provision relating to checks. Just from the standpoint of the sheer volume of check activity in any given county in the state on a daily basis, the security that people place in negotiable instruments and how important they are in our commercial scheme.
Needs a tool that's got to fit that particular problem.
People who object won't be energetic enough to go back and look through the rest of the thing and find out just becomes theft by deception.
Yeah, I think.
Or something else.
Right, yeah.
And you got to spell it out black and white and point to it. Right.
And then if you'll note on page 33 of my commentary, I mentioned that as observed by the Model Penal Code, special bad check legislation has two practical advantages that should be retained, even though a comprehensive theft statute is enacted. One, no actual obtaining of property need be proven. And two, prima facie evidence provisions take care of the intent or knowledge factors. Moreover, the Michigan approach, which I utilized in my draft here, emphasizes the protection of the system of negotiable paper itself. There is a sound policy rationale behind the criminal statute that helps to safeguard public confidence on a commercial system that's so widely used in society on a daily basis. However, since the more serious depredations could be prosecuted for theft by deception, anticipated misdemeanor penalties would be adequate. So I was thinking in terms of a misdemeanor statute here and not a felony, because if it's a real bad aggravated case, you can take him for grand theft by deception or whatever, we eventually end up under a penalty provision. But the plain old run-of-the-mill NSF check case, you wouldn't have to prove that he actually got anything. For it, although in most cases he would have obtained something as a result of this, otherwise you wouldn't have it in court to start with. But there could be instances, for example, where a payment of pre-existing debts, this type of thing, where there might be some question as to whether or not you obtained anything as a result of the check.
We get about 40 interceptions a month.
But it seemed to me that Michigan had a fine idea here. If you have the Uniform Commercial Code, Michigan has it, Oregon has it. If you have the Uniform Commercial Code, if you're going to have a criminal statute related to checks, negotiable instruments, why not tie in your criminal statute directly with these uniform definitions that apply to negotiable instruments? It seemed to me to make a lot of sense. That is, assuming from a policy standpoint that this commission wants to retain the check statute. No.
I think you may not want to, but I think practicality is something
to take. I'm trying to agree.
I'm
good. I don't like to. It's not so much trouble to draw general statutes that could be applied to a whole series of things. I kind of hate to put one out there and put a flag. I think the standpoint of getting it passed.
Why what's the advantage of putting this in as a separate statute when possibly have a little bit of adjusting and working would
add
the definitions to our definitions in forgery and a additional subsection in the forgery thing to cover this there.
Secretary. Retail section of the Associated Oregon Industry won't have to look hard for it, so before he sends out the bulletin to his members, tell them to oppose the code. Is that the vision?
It isn't going to.
Well, actually,
it's in forgery just for purposes of a logical grouping of these offenses. And I wasn't meaning to imply by placing it along with forgery and calling it a related offense that this was just another way of committing forgery.
No, I understand. Strict sense of the word. I don't even forge an instrument that really doesn't belong in forgery either. I mean, that was something that was a separate thing that we put in. Well, I have a preoccupation, almost a mania, keeping additional special statutes down to a minimum. And the way you explain it is kind of logical enough that it's needed. But
I think we're going to have that problem with three or four areas. Rustling. Some of the other things that we have to separate crime, just because there are enough people interested in that thing, they're going to look for a separate crime. If it isn't there, they're not going to go chase it back to you and find out.
Do you think that's really a sufficiently valid reason to do that, Bob?
No, but that's the way a bunch of us wrote the Constitution about 7 years ago. We never done any place with it. Broadened everything out. Spent all our time telling Kitty Musa and Ben that no, really, it still is a crime to do such and such, and we never did persuade them.
Well, if a person commits a crime negotiating a worthless, negotiable instrument, if the offense is fraud and knowing that it will not be honored by the drawee, he negotiates or delivers a worthless negotiable instrument.
Now, the reason I use both is the Uniform Commercial Code has a separate definition for negotiation.
Presently, Law 225 says, willfully and with intent to defraud makes frauds utter or reckless. Any check draft or order upon any bank or other depository for the payment of money, knowing at the time of making, drawing, uttering, or delivering that the maker or drawer or his principal or the corporation has not sufficient the bank depository for the payment of a check draft or order in full upon its presentation, although no express representation is made that there are sufficient funds in or credit with such banks, etc., for its payment.
I was just going to say, this draft changed the law in that respect, and that the knowledge element now is knowledge that the check, knowledge that there is not sufficient funds in the bank at the time you negotiate the check.
Right.
This would change it so to a knowledge that it would not be honored by the drawee, which would, in other words, the kiting of the check would not be criminal under this. Kiting a check, in other words,
raising a otherwise good check.
No, I mean writing a check, blowing
that at the time you pass that check, you don't have funds. You know that by the time it hits the bank, you're going to have funds already covered.
That's called playing the flute.
That's
called playing the flute.
Yeah. But, well, it's also called tiding, I think. And,
no, tiding is taking a $10 check and raising it to $50. An otherwise good check and raising it.
So that would come under the alteration.
Well, that's clause generally called tiding.
Well,
at least in the newspapers, it's generally called.
Well, in the DA's office, our definition of a kiting check was.
Mine agrees with his.
Was to write it and knowing that, and college kids, for example, are notorious for this. They'll go out on Friday afternoon and kite checks all over the place. Knowing that they're not going to be at the bank till Monday or Tuesday, and they'll have money from home by then.
So. Housewives at the end of the month.
Yes, I know. I had to break it up.
But some of them, though, they fall into this thing by doing that, and they find out how easy it is, and then they get into a little more serious problems with it.
I think that the point, especially the special statute, will miss one point that God made the commentary to, and that is that the thing is so universal that the institution needs the protection. We'll take in at our place about $60,000 a month. We'll pay out about $250 a month in petty cash. And we're always having a cash check for petty cash because we don't take in that much cash. We never have no cash on hand, or no cash dollar check to go on a trip. We just don't have it. Everything comes in by check.
Do they use that term knowing that it will not be $100?
Right, and on page 32, I quoted there from the commentary saying that the present one, the knowledge at the time of the making, hardly appears to correspond to commercial practice or popular expectation. The important thing is not whether at the exact time that the instrument is written or passed, the drawee happens to have received funds from or on behalf of the drawer. Rather, the important thing is that by the time the instrument is presented, there is some reason to honor it. Seemed reasonable. Because if you're talking about an intent to defraud, now if the person who passes that check intends to have money in the bank when it's presented for payment, then it's hard to see that there was ever an intent to defraud in the first place.
Aren't we by the terms of this thing just making this really a lever for collection? Really, it stands pretty plainly in this. The present statute is, of course. But this makes it even. It's pretty transparent in this. This is a lever for collection.
Meanwhile, because.
Well, when you give this 10 days to make the thing good.
Well, I think that. Doesn't that really.
It's going to give the DA and the police a chance to weed out some of these cases, or just not weed them out, just defer any action on them until there's some justifiable reason for going ahead with this.
Yeah, sure.
But you know,
the DA will write a letter to the people who say this complaint has been a total complaint in my office, and you have 10 days to do something about it, right? Is this a practical thing?
No, this wasn't the intent of this, to make this something for the police or the district attorney to do. No.
But let's get down to practicality. What really is going to happen here with this 10-day thing in here? in a lot of...
Well, if that day that expired, then he ain't coming. Not my business.
He'd say, I don't even have a prima facie case yet.
I don't think the DA would do it. I think what happened with the DA is you go up and make a complaint, and the DA would say, well, you've got 10 days to call that guy up and tell him we'll issue a complaint for 10 days, you've got to make that check there. It's going to make every burglary's owner enforcer.
You have to be a little more careful than that. That's
a rough idea.
Yeah, that's a rough idea.
Yeah.
You have to be careful how you say that. You can't threaten.
But we had a policy.
Criminal prosecution.
We had a policy in the district attorney's office in Lane County. We never wrote a prospective defendant a demand letter that he pay off a check. Never. And we always advise the police agencies not to do this either, because those kind of things will come back to haunt
you. Oh yeah,
but a trial. You threaten, and pretty soon the man just didn't pay, and then it gives him a lot to talk about the jury when he goes to trial.
Oh, yeah.
That you're just collecting a bill for this complaint is all the state's doing. I think it's bad policy to get into writing letters.
But somehow or other this happens.
I know some police agencies do that.
Yeah.
For example, in Springfield, this is a sore spot with us all the time, was the way Springfield went about.
Well, that's a change.
Because those cases would come in, they'd be 6 months old, and there'd been 40 letters written to somebody before finally we ever hear about the case, you see. And by that time, it's so stale that, you know.
Woody Maddox is an institution over there. I don't know how he survives. I don't know why he's not there.
Of course, this provision here, this wouldn't prevent the district attorney from going ahead and pressing charges if he wanted to. All it would mean would, if he went the criminal route before this had expired, he couldn't rely on the prima facie evidence provisions. But it's not part of the substantive statement of the crimes.
I'd like to see what the reaction is of the people that use this on the time.
Yeah.
It sure does water the soup.
It what?
It
waters the soup?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, you mean it would be less effective, or would be more troublesome from a police standpoint?
Oh, I think it'll cut the effectiveness down tremendously.
You mean the prima facie provisions will cut the enforcement provisions in this down?
It really throws it into the civil collection area more than it is now. I mean, you have to agree with that.
I think we have to look at it in terms of what our objective is. And our objective is to protect society against the malicious, if you will, check faster. The criminal. And the guy that was pulling the green chain and feeding eight kids.
Mm-hmm.
Happens to ride an NSF check, shouldn't be prosecuted.
For kiting one,
there's a safeguard written in here to protect against an abuse of the district attorney's discretion in a situation like that. But biggest single factor in favor of these provisions, I think, is that which we haven't discussed, which relates to making it easier for the DA to prove his case. Because
this
I suppose it's implicit in our present law that that if the defendant did not have an account of the check or the bank from which the check was drawn in his private paycheck.
I don't mind making it easier for the district attorney to pay.
Yeah.
As long as he doesn't abuse his discretion and as long as we don't broaden the crime to let him convict, let him make a crime out of something which is not now a crime that he can't, he doesn't prosecute, that he can't convict. I don't want to create a new series one.
Am I right in this?
I don't think this does.
Or unless you put the defendant in a position where he couldn't immediately defend legitimately.
Let me ask you if I'm right about this. If I enter the state of Oregon from Washington, I have 10 days in which to lay checks from Portland to Medford, up over to Klamath Falls and up to Dallas and get back into Washington before there's any prosecution possible.
No.
But you're
guilty when you first draw it, but...
But after
10 days, why the... prosecutor, easier job to prosecute.
Yeah, but these are $25 checks, and they're not hurting people much. And so I can just lay those checks and finance my trip and move into Washington, and they won't even extradite me.
Well, I think
that,
as I read, this is an either or situation.
Is it?
Yeah, make her draw, have no account to draw E at the time they actually negotiate a clip, or present them to pay within a reasonable time.
Right. The 2A is to cover the no account checks, which now you would be prosecuted for obtaining money under false pretenses. This wouldn't even fall under NSF checks now.
Huh?
No account does not fall under
NSF
checks.
That's right, it doesn't, does it?
That's what Broom versus Glanton says, you see. Now, B2B would cover 165225, which is our in a non-sufficient funds check statute now, would be under 2B.
Okay.
This really combines the two.
All right, now where's the either or?
Well,
it's either A or B.
Well,
I think your friend from Washington would be an A man.
If he didn't have any account at all.
Didn't have any account.
But you know, but all you need to do is have an account in each of these towns, and you go. It's a business practice. Okay, Ed, but you're the district attorney, and somebody is going through the county and laying checks all over, and you're starting to get reports in.
Mm-hmm.
You can go ahead and file your complaint right then. Issue your warrant, pick him up if you can find him. Pick him up right then. These prima facie evidence provisions are going to be important when you go to trial. Not when you arrest.
Yeah.
You see.
But, two things.
Yes.
Well, it says in one, what the crime is. And two, how are you going to prove it? I mean, and two is an additional assistance in proving it.
Sure. And if when you go to trial on this guy, B fits, then you can rely on that. As prima facie evidence of an intent to defraud and knowledge that the checks wouldn't be paid, you see. If he has paid them, what the heck?
Otherwise, you're arresting him on section one, crime on two.
No. You're arresting him on section one, but two is a help to conviction.
And our present statute, Ed, says pretty much the same thing. It says, as against the person making, drawing, uttering, or delivering a check, draft, or order, payment of which is refused by the drawee because the maker or drawer or his principal or the corporation has insufficient funds in or credit with such drawee. Such refusal by the drawee is prima facie evidence of the intent of the person making, drawing, uttering, or delivering such check, draft, or order to defraud, and his knowledge of the insufficiency of funds in the present time.
Fourth is, first, we don't define worthless negotiable instrument.
No, we just define that negotiable.
All right, so
we define negotiable instrument.
Well, we define it by reference, right?
Right.
Okay, so we leave open for interpretation what a worthless negotiable instrument is.
It could be a balance of a note, couldn't it?
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. It could be a promissory note. It could be a check. It could be,
yeah, anything the Uniform Commercial Code says is a negotiable instrument.
And this, I wonder if we get into, by leaving it open, if we leave ourselves open for, or leave some future prosecutor open for a counter argument, as far as what is subjectively the worthless negotiable instrument as opposed to what objectively is. I mean, could it be that the drawer is not worthless as to him, but it's worthless as to him? Could be argued that. You see what I'm trying to drive at? I don't see it real clearly myself, but I'm trying to envision a situation where you have a worthless negotiable instrument other than a no-account check, which wouldn't be a forged or altered instrument that would come within the scope of what we've already done. And I can't.
Which could have been an innocent document.
Innocent as to me,
yeah.
But allegedly not so as to somebody else.
I'm not recording any of these love letters anymore, anyway.
person commits a crime of negotiating a worthless negotiable instrument. What is it?
Is this intended to pertain to other negotiable instruments other than checks?
Yeah, it could. And
I know it could.
And right. I don't think that
where
we would
have. Where do we have an instance of another?
I'm going to prosecute on a pair of bond on this thing because the amount involved is going to be big enough, so he's going to go to the felony.
But if somebody does prosecute a felony and this is here with this language, I'm going to raise a constitutional objection to charging my client with the other. Well, yeah.
Won't fit, John. That's not violation of pussy. Because both statutes give reasonable guidelines to a district attorney or a magistrate or a grand jury as to what kind of conduct is prohibited. It doesn't give unbridled discretion to take one crime and make that particular crime either a felony or a misdemeanor. That's what Perky did.
Well, I'm aware of that. I can't help but think it doesn't remain a problem, though. And I can't help but think that under A, I mean, this overlap business thing, got the OMFP situation, as you suggest, we're just making another, giving the district attorney another alternative here to charging him with OMFP.
Well, of course, I don't think a defendant's going to be very successful if he complains that he has been charged with a misdemeanor rather than a felony.
Oh, but what about the inverse situation? That's what I'm getting at.
Bring him up under a felony, he says that this is really the crime you're charged with, it's a misdemeanor and a felony.
It's got all the same elements. He would have to say it was not.
Well, that's very similar to a couple of the cases that I outlined in that memorandum on Perky.
And I think it's a good outcome.
And I think there's a case in there that's very similar to the problem you're raising here. I can't remember the citation of it offhand, but...
you know, the thing that plagues me is this. We have to approach our work with regard to simplifying the interpretation of the criminal code and closing whatever loopholes that do exist and making it clear both to the defense and the prosecution. And that while we can argue that any question here is going to be settled the way we think it is, the fact that we do have these questions are going to give rise to a whole raft of new Supreme Court decisions when this goes into effect, and we want to minimize that.
Sure, and I couldn't agree more. I think that this is the place to thrash them out. But I think that if Perkey went as far as some people seem to think it goes, then you'd almost be faced with a situation where you'd have to have one all-encompassing statute to cover every type of crime. Otherwise, anytime you had more than one statute that could cover a given set of circumstances, it could be unconstitutional. You couldn't have a very effective criminal code.
I don't think that's the way I read it, because I remember reading the paper you sent us,
yeah,
comments from. It didn't seem to me that it said we should only have one statute to cover.
Oh no, I didn't say that. But yeah.
Well, you see, one of the criteria was, like you said, the court was concerned with a single statute that allowed a DA, grand jury, or magistrate to determine whether a defendant should be charged with a felony or misdemeanor, without providing criteria for distinguishing between the two offenses. Now here we have two of those three elements present, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well,
we don't have a single statute.
No, but we have the other two.
But we don't, because one of the other things that requires is the ability of the DA to charge either way. We provide, this is a misdemeanor, the other's a felony.
But if you start with the same facts, you're saying, mm-hmm. Those facts presented to this attorney would give him a choice.
Would give him a choice, and there's no differentiation between, there's no criteria included for distinguishing between the two offenses. There's no criteria, there's no guideline, there's no standard. To permit the district attorney to differentiate between charging a guy with OMFP under what we've done previously, or negotiating a worthless instrument under PIA.
You have to put a money amount on this.
Well,
sure, there's a guideline, John.
Right, where,
no,
is
we
it? Where is it?
Well, there's a guideline in theft, for example. If we're going to charge him with theft by deception, the elements of the crime are set out there, and of course we'd have to assume that we're going to have a point of departure from between felonies and misdemeanors, higher grades of theft. And it's going to provide that if the amount of the theft is over X number of dollars, it's going to can be prosecuted as for theft by deception, be punishable as a felony. Now, for one thing, you'd be adding another element to the crime, the element of value.
Well, we're going to have a misdemeanor penalty for theft by deception too.
Okay. Sure.
All right. So value really isn't a valid criteria.
No, but you were arguing that we would be charging him with a felony under the other statute, and that your client's argument would be that he's being charged with a felony when he should be charged with a misdemeanor. And if you're going to just charge him with a misdemeanor under theft by deception, and that argument would disappear. He would be charged with a misdemeanor in either event.
In either case.
All right.
Aren't we going to have to provide throughout the system, as I understand it anyway, it works to a great extent, particularly now that every defendant is either represented or has the right to representation for all practical purposes, misdemeanors on up, regardless of the length of sentence or anything else. Aren't we going to have to provide some basis for the system to work? The system works to to a great extent on plea bargaining.
Sure.
If we didn't have, we don't have room for this part to work, why talk about the courtroom in this state, we'd treble it. We've got to have some basis for the district attorney and the defendant's attorney to arrive at hopefully on the defendant's part, the least, that the district attorney is going to have the same leeway and the difference between manslaughter and 2 or 3 degrees of murder.
That's no argument for the inclusion of this offense, because if you have a misdemeanor penalty for a cutoff on theft by deception, although he stole the $50 more than the cutoff, he can still be charged.
The only two reasons for having this then are one, to protect the institution to spell out so that the average guy who doesn't know the thing knows that the banking system and the check system is to be protected.
But this has different elements in it than the OMFB.
Okay, but tell me what they are.
Well, one of them is that under this you don't have to obtain property.
Well,
and isn't that just the same as the difference between larceny from a store and larceny?
Well, now wait a minute. No.
Larceny doesn't have to be in a store.
The difference between larceny from a store and larceny is that larceny from a store doesn't prescribes a felony penalty without regard to the amount. If I go into a store and steal a 39-cent wrench, that's a felony because I stole. But larceny carries it has to be over $75.
But petty larceny.
Well, it's outside the store.
Mm-hmm, but the district attorney can charge
right.
The guy that steals a 39-cent wrench from the store with petty larceny.
That's right.
Right. Or right now under our statutes, you could charge him. You could charge him with shoplifting,
mm-hmm. larceny in a store, or petty larceny.
You could charge him with shoplifting, larceny in a store, or petty larceny.
Mm-hmm. And you haven't run up against Perky because
he
can't.
All right, okay, you're convincing me.
that was a good illustration.
That was. But let's, under the larceny, you don't have to obtain, under larceny, theft, as we have it now, which embraces the obtaining money by culture, in order to complete the crime, you have to obtain something.
Yeah.
Here, all you have to do is to negotiate or deliver.
With intent to defraud.
With intent to defraud. All right. I have another note here. I got 4 objections. I think you're annihilating me.
This is the way.
Negotiating or delivering comprehend a completed act. You don't take into account here an uttering situation, do you?
You mean just handing it to somebody and I says, no, I won't take it. So
right,
far.
Right.
Well, in that case,
I'm going to mention that in class until I recheck the definition of delivery.
Well, yeah. If
it gets out of your hand in the hand of another.
See, delivery with respect to instruments, documents, and title, chattel paper, or securities means voluntary transfer of possession.
All right, so that comprehends completed act.
Transfer of possession.
So I go into Bob Chandler's business office and give him an NSF check in payment of a political ad, and I hand it to him. Says, I won't take
delivered?
It. I won't take it. It's not delivered. It's not negotiated.
Well, it's delivered under that.
No, it isn't.
You gave it up voluntarily to me. And I say, I look at it and say it's no good, and I give it back. That doesn't
negate
the fact that you gave it to me in the first place.
Say a typical situation in a Safeway store or a Fred Meyer store. I say, will you cash this check? You have a Fred Meyer credit card? No. I won't cash it. Now, I'm guilty of uttering right there, and under the present NSF statute, I could be prosecuted. But there hasn't been an act of delivery, and there hasn't been a negotiation. So,
why wouldn't it be delivering under this definition of service?
Because I think that's.
Well, you're cutting it pretty fine here, and I. Whether that would be transfer of possession or not, I think that if you handed it to the clerk and the clerk took it, you would have a completed transfer.
I did too, but you might have just put it down there on the counter and looked at it.
If you just put it on the counter and he just looks at it with his hands in his pockets,
I see the instructions to the safe.
I don't know if it's a transfer.
Take the check in your hand or just, you know.
The instructions would be don't take checks.
Of course, well, the other problem is, what harm has been done? What harm has been done? If you give me that check and I say no, and then you take the cash out of your pocket, give it to me, and I put that in the till.
Oh,
then I go next door and take advantage of somebody else. And you're.
I don't see that it hurt this at all, the man, Hunter. Do you, Don?
No.
Makes me feel better. For what?
Negotiates, utters, or delivers. Huh? Mm-hmm.
And then that would refer back to the definition of utter we had in section 1. To utter means to issue, deliver, publish, circulate, disseminate, transfer, or tender a written instrument or other object to another.
Well, that would require comma after negotiates, the insertion of the word utters in section 1, and would require in 2B, negotiation, comma, uttering, or delivery and payment of compute. That those two places would that take care of?
Where's the second
point? 2B. Second line of 2B.
Well, if you just had an uttering, you wouldn't have any presentment anyway.
Mm-hmm. So you don't need
it.
You
don't need it. Then you need a, under 3, you need a G, then, wouldn't you? Definition of uttering.
Well, no, I don't think so, because we can, under section 1, see, when we complete this, we can say, as used in this chapter,
right now, it still hasn't been answered to my satisfaction how we have worthless negotiable instrument in here, or why, or what this could possibly cover. So far as worthless negotiable instruments concerned, other than no account check, in view of the forgery and alteration business that we've already gone through. But before I get to that objection, let me think about it. I wonder if because the language we have in B, 2B, this defense argument couldn't be raised. You have a prosecution for the person negotiating the worthless negotiable instrument, and the district attorney fails to prove that fails to show that there was an effort made by this 10-day provision.
released for judgment of acquittal because the DA didn't comply with the requirement of the statutory proof. Now, this is really fuzzy on my,
if the fellow comes into the court and he says, look, I really intended to comply with the law, I can, in 10 days I intended to take care of this, but they went out and arrested me before I even had a chance to comply with what I think the law to be.
The DA didn't go and check 10 days later.
Yeah.
To see if it was made good.
Yeah. Well, I think you could make it good within 10 days. You can still be guilty.
Sure, I do too. I couldn't agree more. And
you say it.
But if he didn't make it good within 10 days, you know damn well he's guilty.
The trial's not going to be held within 10 days.
It's a burden on the DA to show that he didn't make it good within 10 days.
No.
It is not.
But if the DA can show that, he is up another notch on his proof.
But it's not incumbent upon him to do it in order to successfully prosecute.
I would certainly think that.
No, I don't.
It's just prima facie evidence.
He's going to be better off if he can show these things.
That's all he needs to prove. But if he can prove it otherwise, he's got the job done.
All that would do for him. Which would be significant, there's no question about it, but it would show that there was an intent to defraud on the part of the defendant, and further that he had knowledge that this check would not be honored when it was presented for payment. If he could show B, if the district attorney could show B, then he'd have a prima facie case of intent to defraud, but he might have all kinds of other evidence on intent to defraud, other checks that had been passed,
but really, I still think that the practical working of this thing is going to be that the district attorney will not move until he has his 10-day period. By that time, the real pro, the fellow that's really designed to take care of, is going to be well gone. Well, I don't agree with you. I think the DA, if he's got knowledge that this guy is a pro and that he's passed a whole flock of them and he happened to get caught in his town, he's going to move.
Sure.
And he's got that evidence there of a course of conduct.
Yeah, and he's not gonna prosecute that guy on a misdemeanor charge.
Well, why not make it 24 hours? What's wrong with 24 hours?
Because the banks are closed for 2 days of inspection, sometimes three.
And this is some reasonable help for the housewife that is a poor bookkeeper and shows her heart in the right place. It wouldn't be any good to the guy that's floating a whole series of checks.
No, I think you have to recognize that the district attorney is going to know the professional check writer as well as the police do. And is going to move accordingly. But at the same time, I'm realistic enough to know that this written into the law is going to give the DA an out to lay off these cases that don't warrant immediate action until this 10-day provision has been complied with. I think that's to be expected.
Let's take the unlikely event that the DA has got a whole slug of these things and he decides to prosecute this guy on a misdemeanor charge. Bring charges under him against this and arrest him. Have him arrest him. It's unlikely that the trial will be held in 10 days. If the guy is incarcerated during that 10 days, can he successfully argue that he didn't have a chance to make the thing good because he was a who's gun? Then I don't see the problem.
Okay. Why can't he?
Because this making it good, I mean, failure to make it good within 10 days is not an element of the crime. This doesn't say that a guy does as if he issues a worthless check and doesn't make it good in 10 days.
We've written into the law here and made it part of a prima facie case. And this fellow is arrested. So he wrote this check. There aren't any other elements approved. He wrote this check, and there he is standing before the judge in district court.
Why am I here? I thought I had 10 days to make this good.
Well, that's like the colorblind sound. Working on the old law before they raise the age of consent from 16 to 18.
Well, that's almost like saying...
He thought he had 2 years.
We're talking, I guess, in, we're talking about matters of substance and matters of procedure.
Yeah, really. This is an evidentiary. This is an evidentiary provision in the statute. Just like these are evidentiary provisions we've got in our present statute about what makes a prima facie case. Or our prima facie intent to defraud in our theft of services. That was a prima facie case if he left, if he absconded without paying. See, that's prima facie.
That calls
you,
upon
you have another one that I disagree with, but you don't have to wait for him to abscond without paying to go ahead and charge him.
But you have little
it makes you stronger,
if you do.
It gives you a stronger case.
None of those are pretty well covered in our discussion of that, when we covered that particular thing, theft of services. That this is about the only evidence that you can use.
No.
I
don't think the evidence that you have in many instances.
Yeah, and this is about the only evidence that you can use.
Mm-hmm.
No, it isn't. Well,
the evidence fails.
My point is that you've got to keep in mind the difference between the elements that go to make up the crime itself.
Oh, I sure
and you know, and the provisional elements for or the provisional
I understand that, but when you write something if you leave it out of, if you leave it out and just say it's pass it by word of mouth to the district attorney or something like that, and they give them 10 days, that'd be one thing. But when you put it in the statute here, here's prima facie evidence.
But the fact that it doesn't exist isn't prima facie evidence that the crime wasn't committed. Is it? I mean, it doesn't work in reverse, does it?
No, wait a minute. Say that again.
Well, you're saying that it's prima facie evidence of a crime, intent to defraud, if this presentment was made and the guy failed to make good within 10 days.
Right.
The fact that present was made and nobody asking to make good within 10 days isn't prima facie evidence that he didn't commit a crime, is it?
No.
No.
Then I think this provision becomes necessary if for no other reason than the housewife who's the lousy bookkeeper.
What if she makes good within 11 days? Well,
then it's a jury question if they want to accept it, maybe.
But all this talks about, and as I understand it, is one of the elements of negotiating the virtual instrument, which is intent to defraud. You can prove intent to defraud by a statement, an admission, a series of similar transactions under rule in State versus Long. Or I don't know how else, but I don't find any premise to this. Now that my question that it isn't incumbent upon the DA to prove this has been answered,
really the purpose in here, Ed, of having this is not to water it down, but to make it more enforceable. Really, that's the whole idea. That's the whole idea of any prima facie evidence provision, is to aid enforceability of it.
The way it is now, I suppose, there's a lot of housewives that 10 minutes ago, can't keep track of my bank account. I write a check one day, my husband writes it the next day, and we don't write it down. But if you go for 10 days like that, then that becomes evidence against you, which is sufficient to convict you.
Unless it's overcome, right?
Unless it's over, then the housewife can still say that, but it's some evidence against you, which the 10 days went by.
But if you could show that in your case, that standing alone would get you to the jury. So.
Yeah, I can see. Defendant didn't want to commit perjury and didn't take the stand to rebut it. There was no defense evidence. This is the only one.
Well, so I'm not sure. Wish I was sure that I see your. I see what you're saying, but I don't know whether I really accept it or not, because.
And you're afraid that the people that are reading this won't see through it, so that
won't differentiate the substance from the form.
If you had a client that was charged with this, and they didn't have much other evidence, wouldn't you plead that?
Plead what?
Well, that your client planned him to make this good, and here's the law. It says he has 10 days, and that's what he thought. Heavens, here he is in court, and why is he here in court? If that's what you're using as prima facie evidence, and that's what you're hanging your hat on, because that's what you said, you're going to use this to hang your hat on as a piece of evidence. But here the fellow is in court in 5 days, he's being arraigned, and he says, I thought I had 5 more days. Make this good.
No, but the statement of the crime says that he passes his check knowing that it will not be honored by the drawee. It doesn't say knowing that it would not be honored by the drawee, and that he would be given 10 days to pay it. It says knowing that it would not be honored by the drawee. This 10-day provision has got nothing to do with honoring of the check by the drawee. Because by the time when he receives this notice, that's what he's received. He's receiving notice that it has not been honored. That this is a notice of dishonor that he has received. That would bring this prima facie evidence provision into the play. And so the crime is committed the minute that it's dishonored. Same. And you'd ask this defendant, well, did you think the check would be paid when it went to the bank? Well, no, I didn't, but I thought I could pay it 10 days later. That wouldn't, I don't think that'd get you first base.
We're not trying to create everybody an automatic 10-day line of credit at the bank.
In other words, did you think that this check would be paid when it got to the bank? And if you didn't think it would be paid when it got to the bank, you committed the crime. If you knew it wouldn't be paid when it got to the bank.
Well, you have to answer that question, okay?
Well,
you don't really have to answer that question.
Well, I mean, for the purposes of arguing this thing,
you can make the charges and you've got no evidence to.
Prima facie things, they tend to become standards for the court and everyone else, and the first thing you know, that's the way it's interpreted, and shoot, you've written something in there that you didn't need to have.
I'm going to have that problem that's first of January.
What is that?
Well, the new attorney general's going to keep in touch with his district attorneys and let them know what the intent is. How we're going to run this show.
Well, I'll tell you what. I know both of them, and I don't know.
Now, let's switch all of this. Straight chalk.
I don't know if I need chalk or not.
It's bonding language that we put into the other one without the supporting language in the other three or four paragraphs that we should have put with it. Of course, if this is something that you want to give up on later, that's all right. I don't mind that. But if we're serious about this,
I'm serious about it. I didn't know anything. We're serious about it. about it. I think if I were working the check detail in a police department, that I'd feel a lot better if I went over to the DA's office with and tried to put together a case. If I had something like this in the statute, because at least I would know that even if we might be kind of skinny on intent to defraud, that since this 10 days have gone by, at least we've got a prima facie case against this guy. And we've got enough to put him right there. See?
Well, you put him in jail on the first or second day.
Yeah.
And you come up there and say, well, I fully intended to pay this off. I'm just like the housewife and everyone else.
Well, he's got
the only difference between me and the housewife is that I distributed a 100 down the road, but I still intended to.
But look, here I am in jail. How can I pay those darn things off? I got arrested. The housewife didn't get arrested. I think I ought to have equal protection under the law. So.
And when's he going to say that, though, after the state's rested? After the state's rested, and if they can show this, then they've got enough to get past a motion or a judgment of acquittal. They've got, that defendant's going to have to present some evidence to overcome the prima facie case and intent to defraud.
Well, I don't want to move over this. I've got some misgivings about it, that's all. Even though you're very persuasive, I have some misgivings.
I've been persuaded.
Have you?
Well,
they used to call me Easy Ed.
I wouldn't argue for it because I wrote it, but I do argue for it because I think it strengthens the statute, Ed. I think from a law enforcement standpoint, it strengthens it.
I think if you're talking about felonies where you can go out of state to get them and all that, I've got some doubts. I'll let it rest.
I think what we're talking about more than anything else with regard to this section is a misdemeanor. The NSF misdemeanor section. Now, the law, as you drafted it, will provide that a person commits the crime of negotiating a worthless negotiable instrument if, with intent to defraud and knowing that it won't be honored by the drawee, he negotiates, utters, or delivers a negotiable instrument. There's two elements. Intent to defraud and knowing that it won't be honored, and negotiating, uttering, or delivering it to delivering a worthless negotiable instrument. Now, it's prima facie evidence of one of those elements. If the maker didn't have any account at the time he negotiated, uttered, or delivered the instrument. And it's also prima facie evidence of intent to defraud and knowledge if presentment was made within a reasonable time after negotiation or delivery and payment was refused by the drawee for insufficient funds and the maker or drawer failed to make good within 10 days after receiving a notice of dishonor. So, your question arises with respect to the latter.
Right, I'm not worried about it.